National Parliament, right of the 3rd of May 2019, order of proceedings, the Council of Standing Order, the Honourable Chief Minister.
Mr. Speaker, I first move under Standing Order 73 to suspend Standing Order 71 in order to proceed with the laying of a paper on the table.
Mr. Speaker, Carried.
Mr. Speaker, I have the honour to lay on the table the Gibraltar Annual Commissioning Plan 2019-2020.
Order tonight. We now move to questions. And can I just with question number 49, the Honourable Alec Mills.
Mr. Speaker, I think before we proceed to that stage of the proceedings, if I might just prevail upon your discretion to enable me to say a few words about a member of the community that I've recently asked me to be part of this year. Mr. Speaker, it was great personal challenge and indeed fabulous of the members of the government I represent in this House, and the doubt of all honourable members indeed, and of the political parties that I represent in particular, that I want to just reflect for a moment on the sudden passing of a staunch Gibraltarian patriot, my, I think it's fair to say, friend of everyone you and most people in this House earlier this week. As the House is well aware, William Thurtherby passed away at the beginning of the week, and he was an energetic and hard-working member of our community. Both in his private capacity as a successful businessman, principally from the iconic Red House with his family, who was united for many years, and indeed as a political activist. And it was in that later capacity that I first knew him and in which he really was in his element. We contributed extensively, of course, to the business community, to the board of the Chamber of Commerce as well, and he campaigned on initiatives to promote the democratic rights of the Gibraltarians, including the right to vote in European elections and the struggle against joint sovereignty amongst many others. He also contributed in the field of law enforcement, actually laid on the table the policing plan, and William was a member of the police authority and police consent board when it was first instituted. When I first came across him, it was to discuss the evils of the Brussels Agreement. He was one of those who then helped to carry the coffin of the Brussels Agreement symbolically as part of an SDGG amendment to this day, to Parliament. In defiance of the British government, and indeed, I think, of the government of the day. But perhaps Wood's greatest contribution, in which I had the most contact with him, was the chairman of the SDGG. He was a founder member of that group. I remember being there in my late teenage years, and it was a meeting every Tuesday at 7 o'clock in the summer. I was there religiously, and I learned a lot from him and the other leading lights of that organization. Indeed, it was with Dennis Matthews in the chair and with Willie in the committee that the decision was taken to dismiss the Denise Matthews case, and indeed, later this month, I hope we'll be voting in the European election as a result of exactly that decision. We then went on to lead the SDGG for 7 years. And he went on to address the United Nations Committee of 24 and the 4th Committee in his capacity as chairman of the group. And he and I coincided in New York on a number of occasions as a result. And I will remember with great fondness those moments that we enjoyed together in New York. I'm sure that the whole of the Gibraltarian family, and Willie's family in particular, will feel just as proud of the contribution that he has made to help us all develop a democratic support. And I'm going to ask the House to observe a minute's silence, perhaps not now, but if other members want to do something, once we've all had an opportunity to reflect on his contribution.
Honourable members, I'm going to issue this. Mr. Speaker, Her Majesty will be joined to the government, of course, in remembering the life of Mr. Thurtherby. I do not know Mr. Thurtherby that well, unlike many members in this House.
And it's great that we have recently reflected on a life well lived in relation to his contribution to Ukrainianism and as well as 9 long years as chairman of the SDG. And it is right to remark on his contribution to public life and service to the people of our community. Our condolences and sincere condolences to his family, and I know that others on this side of the house wish to share some more special memories of Mrs. Lester and Beavis for long ones are one friend of Susan and the community.
I also express my sadness at William's passing away. Apart from being a close personal friend of mine, he has been, not for a long while, but he has been a active member of the Executive Committee of the AACR, which perhaps is not very well known. It was, of course, before the Brussels Agreement.
Ms. Vida, I'd like to add a few words of tribute of my own to what has already been said. But William was with a friend, and we worked very closely at the time when the Spirit of Emulation was voted in for Israel, and Sandra was a founding member of that organization. And I remember going to him relatively recently when I was in a talk, which I after talk out of it again back in the Garden Library a few weeks ago. So obviously, very thankful to them of his passing. He took over from Dennis Matthews in September 1998 as the presenter, the chairman of the Social Termination Group, really preferred to be known as a spokesman of the Social Termination Group. And he was there for 9 years, and actually, at some of those 9 years, they were difficult for him in that context. But he was, as the chief minister has already said, a patriot. He was a libertarian, first and foremost, and almost a libertarian. Nationalism is love for his homeland and for his country. A staunch defender of our right to self-determination and of our right to decolonization. So I'd like to add my own tribute and my own condolences to his family.
William was a very, very good friend, and a better friend of my father. Something that perhaps is not known is that he did his best, in fact, to persuade not to go into politics. And he and John Romans, I recall, well, he was right, indeed. He and John Romans, I recall, had me advanced the idea of the outset for what seemed to be an eternity, trying to persuade him to take over from him and the rest of his being. And the hope to go into frontline politics. And indeed, as a chief minister, I also recall the trip to New York in which the Western United Nations, when I was part of the Gibraltar delegation, and indeed in the Western United Nations, I think it was in 2013, as we were then Labour Party, William was also there, and we had long, long discussions about politics. He wasn't to speak up a gentle person, very easy to discern, and very amazing and very good to see, always with a big smile on his face. From a young age, he was committed to free association, and in his later life, he was committed to independence for the group. Indeed, in that context, for myself, and supporters of the concept of devolved integration, we had long discussions. And I can tell you that I was just agreeing at the end of discussions to him, the argument to him, and Morrison, none of them would give way. He was a man of principle. We made a main contribution, and this is not widely known to devolved public life. When he was asked to go to Morocco, and he was invited to this moment in time, given what has been said over the last week about the Moroccan community or the contribution of the Moroccan community to the role for us to find the trade of the country, he was asked to go to Morocco in order to assist to evaluate Moroccan labor, experience, and experience on behalf of the government before they went to the vote. We don't need hundreds of more from that maximum on that basis. Will you help to Father Abraham, as we all know, former minister and a distinguished member of our community, to run this entrusted business? My father knew really very well, and we're lifelong friends, in fact. Again, something that is not widely known, but when my father led London leadership in general strike in 1972, he then went to the United Kingdom in order to lead one of the trade ministers of the Union there. We came back because the family of Brexit, and my father, because of his trade union activities, was blacklisted by businesses in the world. He seemed to pay employment to the world. And really, employed my father in his father's construction business, in order to ensure that my family obviously had good values in what were very difficult times. William made sure that his Moroccan labor force were well looked after, and he and my father tells me that he and William would go to the company's property where they were housed every week to ensure that his Moroccan labor force, anything they needed, they were well taken care of. Essentially that his workforce was well taken care of. And I think that that is a measure of the gentleness and the kindness of the man. My dad described him as one of the most humane people that he had ever met. And to all his friends, he will be fully missed. And Mr. Speaker, all that remains to me is to offer my condolences to his family, to his son, who is here in the gallery today, for you ought to be a key part of your family. My name is Hassan.
Mr. Speaker, I thank the Chief Minister and other honourable members of the House for their beautiful tribute to Willie Fafferty, a man who gave so much of himself to Gibraltar, a man who will no doubt leave a mark on our political landscape, and a man that Gibraltar owes a lot to. Because without looking for any protagonism, Mr. Speaker, and without any airs and graces, he was a man who was always present to strengthen our plight for the right to self-determination simply because it was the right thing to do, while wanting nothing in return. Mr. Speaker, Willie Fafferty's political roots are deeply ingrained in our community. He was raised in a political family, with his father, the late Abraham Fafferty, having been a formidable politician and mayor of Gibraltar, and also a great influence, friend, and mentor to my late father, Sir Dr. Hassan, during very difficult times in Gibraltar. This was certainly shaped with his self-esteem, values and convictions to become the defender of Gibraltar that he became when he founded the self-determination group for Gibraltar, delivering speeches and strong messages from 28th of National Day to the UN in New York. With his self-esteem, he remained a strong ambassador for the Gibraltarian cause right up until the day he died. Father, Mr. Speaker, as my honourable friend, Mr. Speaker, has just said, Willie Fafferty is largely responsible for recruiting many members of the Moroccan workforce decades ago, when they were so badly needed in the building trade particularly. Mr. Speaker, to advance our tiny and challenging economy at the time, his initiative was a great resource to us all, Mr. Speaker. This man was an intellectual though, through and through. In the last couple of years, he had the ongoing mission where he was writing a book on his family history and his family business. And he wasn't doing that, Mr. Speaker. He was managing his family business or collecting pieces of interest, and even undertaking deep studies and analyses on the faces and the pillars of Mercury. For me personally, Mr. Speaker, I will forever treasure the conversations I had with him, especially in the last couple of years, and his unwavering support for my political project, inspiring me each time to keep working for the people of Gibraltar, apparently the opposite tack to the one he took with my honourable friend to the right. I truly believe that it was the right time to bring about a new brand of politics for our community. His loyalty and belief in my work is something that has helped me tremendously in my own trajectory, so I thank him, albeit posthumously, for his support to me and the many people like myself that he has inspired during his lifetime to fight the good fight on behalf of the people of Gibraltar. it is people like him that make society better and more advanced. And for this, we owe him a huge debt of gratitude, Mr. Speaker. I take this opportunity to extend my most heartfelt condolences to William's children, Sasha, and my good friend Vita, his siblings, cousins, and of course his beloved grandchildren, who will most certainly be feeling a huge void right now, but one which I am sure will be healed in time as they encounter wonderful memories and the value that this special man has left with them, as he has done with the rest of us, Mr. Speaker. Thank you.
Speaker, I am, from what I've heard, confirmed in my view of the wide political judgment. I want to thank all honourable members for their kind of words and in friendship and solidarity and in sorrow that the House Party is sharing. We now move to answers to questions, and we commence with question 49. The questioner is the Honourable A.S. Gilman.
Mr. Speaker, can the government provide details regarding drugs seized by law enforcement officers at the Bayside Sports Complex in January 2013?
Answer the Honourable Minister for Health, Care and Justice. Mr. Speaker, I will answer to the Honourable Gentleman in my answer to question 576 of 2018, the RCP does not recall statistics on millions where drugs are recovered. Question number 50, the Honourable Edison.
On the public sector has been tested under a drug-free workplace policy announced by the government in August 2019, including a number of positive and negative tests and substance abuse cases.
Answer the Honourable Minister for Health, Care and Justice. Mr. Speaker, further to the press release on the 2nd of August of last year, I would like to be able to say that the RCP, in consultation with my ministers, introduced a drug-free workplace policy. The RCP are now able to test with a total of 25 officers tested so far, all of which have come back negative.
Question number 51, the Honourable Edison.
Mr. Speaker, further to question 545 of 2018, can the government provide a date for which the ECR EHR system payment for the correspond? And explain why there are three providers involved in the system and for what each invoice actually relates to.
Answer the Honourable Minister for Health, Care and Justice. Mr. Speaker, I would like to ask you to get into question 52. Question 52, the Honourable Alexander.
The state has government provide details regarding the ambulance and emergency dispatch system, the purchase, including the supplier, the base purchase, the base commission, and the cost.
Answer the Honourable Minister for Health, Care and Justice. Mr. Speaker, CARE 21 assisted the team study to identify a supplier for the electronic health record portal system. A
part of the DHA's electronic health record for human support. The contract provided the framework by which Transmitter One would procure the electronic patient record services on behalf of the DHA. This has now provided the project to join. Action Information Systems Limited, taken over by EMIS Health, were responsible for the provision of electronic health records and associated services, including AMD software, called Symphony, eClimate PMI, which is the patient master index, which assesses patient demographics, EMIS Web, for PCP pharmacy and prescribing. I now hand over to the Honourable Gentleman, Mr. Speaker, please schedule containing the requested invoice details in respect of each service provider. The training package, a license to operate an ambulance dispatch system, was purchased from Priority Medical Dispatch in October 2011. The cost of the project was £83,605.54. The system has not yet been commissioned.
It's taken a while to be away for the test to be distributed. So I'll ask if everyone's doing the question for the people. Can the minister explain why 7 years later the actual system for the emergency dispatch for the ambulance service has not actually become operational?
Mr. Speaker, this is a system that would require the input from different departments and agencies, not just the DHA. We also require input from departments that are the responsibility of some of my colleagues. I know that the Commissioner of Police is in fact very keen to be able to use the system, and he told me that he has started the process of being able to consult with different agencies to see whether the system could become operational.
Can I ask the Honourable Minister if he's satisfied with the implementation of the prescription system or whether there are any problems with software implementation?
Mr. Speaker, there seems to be a technical issue in respect of automation. So that it's important, of course, to be able to reconcile the number of pharmaceutical item products that are sold on by the pharmacist to the end user. And whereas EMIS as a whole does seem to be working well and operates effectively, there seems to be an issue with the automatic reconciliation. And so the DHA and EMIS have been working to make sure that reconciliation happens in an automated fashion correctly.
Therefore be the reason for why there may have been reported delays in terms of the pharmacy on amounts on the prescription system, but it's based on the rate dispensed and obviously our places of payment in the DHA.
That's correct, Mr. Speaker. And through the automated functionality that we talk about entirely, there is the DHA has to conduct this exercise manually. As you can imagine, given the volume of items that are prescribed, the exercise of manually carrying out this exercise takes a bit of time, and sometimes I have to hear that could be missed.
Question number 53, the Honourable Edison.
What are the government's recommendations on this with regard to consultation to increase the number of hospitals?
Answer the Honourable Minister for Health, Care and Justice.
Mr. Speaker, I will answer this question together with questions 54 to 58.
Question number 54, the Honourable Alex Lamas.
Mr. Speaker, what is the current average waiting time?
The government for
Peter regarding the rumour of the state of the Pope's state of the House when they came to the Prince's Square in London together with the current Mighty Red State and its new Norfolk Square property.
Question number 55, Noble Elephant.
Do you think of what is the current average waiting time for services acquiring all the other services?
Question 56, the Honourable Elephant.
Mr. Speaker, Canada has provided the number of diagnoses of chronic obstructive pulmonary disease by such in 2012.
Question 57, the Honourable Elephant.
Mr. Speaker, Canada has provided the number of incidents of cancer by such in 2012.
Question 58, the Honourable Elephant.
Mr. Speaker, what is the current average waiting time for patients to receive treatment for the pandemic?
Answer the Honourable Minister for Health, Care and Justice.
Mr. Speaker, the policy in respect of the accommodation of sponsored patients on a rest call where visiting rather than hospitals is that, wherever possible, private house will be the first option. If for any medical reason and or because private house accommodation is not available, then the GHA sponsored patients can identify a suitable alternative. The room rates at Cape House at its new location are £50 per night. Room rates, however, were not applied at its former location. Previously, Cape House had received an annual grant of £50,000 from the government. Audiology services can be divided into two key areas, hearing tests and hearing aids. There is no waiting time for hearing tests. On the receipt of a referral from a clinician for a hearing test, a patient's test can be scheduled in the same week or soon after at the convenience of the patient. With regards to hearing aids, there are currently 104 patients waiting for hearing aids. 20 hearing aids are fitted each month. This is due to the need to make an individual mold for the patients there and then to have the aids made and fitted. A new full-time audiologist, Mr. Joe Quinn, doesn't work with the GHA on the 7th of January of this year. She's currently being supported by Mr. Tony Lauder, who is conducting a handover of the role. Michelle is also working very closely with Mr. Julian Galina, a newly appointed ENT surgeon, to review audiology services overall. Mr. Speaker, COPD is a singular condition and is not divided by time. The GHA is not able to provide exact data regarding the number of COPD diagnoses per year since 2012. Since the VHS patient database, EMIS, was introduced in 2015, both existing and newly diagnosed COPD patients have been systematically added to the database. I can however confirm that there are currently a total of 581 COPD patients registered. Mr. Speaker, in relation to the incidence of cancer, information requested is contained in the signal. I now hand over to the Honourable Gentleman. Mr. Speaker, the current average waiting time for patients to receive treatment at a pain clinic is as follows. Invasive infiltration treatment, urgent, no wait, up to 2 weeks, routine 16 minutes.
With regards to question 58 of 2019, I've actually got more than 2 consistent claims to have been waiting for in excess of a year. We've seen the potential. Given the answer of the Minister of the Senate, there isn't any waiting time. I found that to be right in the field with a detail of the unit consistency that you can look into the matter of the issue.
Mr. Speaker, I believe the patients who have not been waiting at that time are nowhere close to the 2 year. As I've just explained, as we referrals who have no wait whatsoever or after 2 weeks, and for the non-urgent routine referrals are not nearer to 2 weeks. At one level, gentlemen, of course, thank you so much for having me. But even after the following, to tell me those people right from the respect of the constituents, you can do so at any time.
Question number 59, the Honourable Elephant.
Mr. Speaker, since the House since in the House, the in-house to one session, and Harmony have received more than a single one to one session.
I think the Honourable Minister for Health Care and Justice.
There has been a significant consulting clinical psychologist promotion to an interview in October of last year. 41 in patients with open meals have received one to one sessions, of which 36 have received more than one to one session. In addition, Dr. Barber has provided psychology services to 21 persons who are not patients at OpenView and 5 as patients at OpenView.
Question number 60, the Honourable Elkin.
The State Canada will provide a schedule with a detailed approach, translated patients during the ongoing response facility since October 2014, previously including the first paid by the employee, origin of transfer, destination upon transfer, whether the original house has been replaced by the supply worker or the ULS in the case.
Answer the Honourable Minister for Health Care and
Justice. Yes, Mr. Speaker, I would answer the question together with questions 61 and 62.
Question number 61, the Honourable Elkin.
With the speaker from December 2017, Canada has taken a 40 debate with the composition of cancer staff at the primary care centres, including how many of the employees are employed directly by the CDC and how many are employed by a supply worker CDC.
Question number 62, the Honourable Elkin.
With the speaker, as of the 21st of January 2019, family workers provide the services in the health and care sector and to the occupied worker agency.
Answer the Honourable Minister for Health Care and Justice.
Mr. Speaker, I now hand over to the Honourable Gentleman a schedule with information requested related to transfers of ambulance and dental services since October 2017.
Mr. Speaker, just for the purpose of enhancement, I've just told Frank that I cannot find the schedule. So I'm asking for that to be printed and then I will send it to the Honourable Gentleman. In respect of answer to question 61, I now hand over a schedule with information requested in relation to the cancer staff at a primary care centre.
Mr. Speaker, as of the 21st of January, there were 321 EDC workers providing services within the health and care sectors. As of the 3rd of May, there are currently 184 EDC supply workers providing services within the health and care sectors. On the 14th, 15th, and the 13th of May, and on the 27th of June of this year, of course, interviews will be taking place for industrial and non-industrial posts within the health and care sectors. On the conclusion of the recruitment process, the only agency workers providing services in the health and care sector will be those conducting domiciliary care within the care agency.
Question number 63, the Honourable Elkin.
Canada will provide details regarding any service level agreement which has been entered into by the CDC since January 2012.
I'll be the Honourable Minister for Health, Care and Justice.
Mr. Speaker, since January 2012, the CDC has entered into service level agreements for the following medical centres: Great Ormond, Street Hospital, Imperial Health Care Hospitals, Moorfields Eye Hospital, Royal Marsden Hospital, Gowes and St Thomas's Trust, South London and Maudsley Hospital, University College London Hospitals, St George's Hospital, Leicester University Hospitals, NHS England, Zanet Hospital, Cologne Salud, Moderna, Clinica Havon Genesis Care, Clinica Universidad de Navarra, and Group Hospital Speaker Island Provider, I think, copy to speak from the gentleman who couldn't be easier than just reading off here.
Could I ask if any of the healthcare providers listed who served on the Green Square incidentally have now been terminated? Peter, will you answer that question?
Question number 54, the Honourable Alex Yaman.
Mr. Speaker, if the government committee to amend the current legislation to deliver into Gibraltar, in order for our parents, when they wish to register the birth of their baby, to deliver still prior to the current 24-week threshold of this service.
Part of the Honourable Minister of Healthcare and Justice. Mr. Speaker, I think honourable gentlemen know that presidents haven't been able to recall their loss in the Book of Remembrance. It has been confirmed as taken at 20 weeks ago. After 20 weeks, parents can be issued a chart to have their own message inscribed and return to maternity ward from recording and the marble prints in the Dream Chair's Guardian of Serenity. Mr. Speaker, I have explained to the honourable gentlemen that to register stillbirth below the 24-week threshold raises an important long-term issue, namely, reducing the defined period of 24 weeks for the registration of stillbirth in the Birth and Death Registration Act. I cannot comment the Birth and Death Registration Act, as I'm not the Minister for Civil Services and Registration. And I think I have suggested to the honourable gentlemen with the Speaker Committee and with the Honourable Chief Minister to discuss the legal issue.
Mr. Speaker,
may I have a single question
for Kevin Ray?
Yes.
The Minister has passed around the schedule in answer to question 61 and we say the daily fair. That counts as fat is I take the first one, the total of 25 for the first quarter of 2017. And then it lists 5 as being DHA employees, 7 as the workers, that only makes it 15. None of the numbers tally the total. Perhaps I'm misleading something or you know, where are the missing figures? No, Mr. Speaker, the Honourable Gentleman is correct. The bonus tally, because the question relates to DHA employees. So the other employees are public sector workers, not directly involved with the DHA, but it could be GDC or it could be civil servants. I don't have the exact detail, and maybe I do. I'm afraid I don't have the exact detail of the composition of the remaining of the balance of the directly employed workers. So they don't speak to a DHA directly employed, it can only be because they are public sector workers, not to be employed but either DHA or civil servants.
Question number 65, the Honourable Dean Stephen.
In relation to all offenders convicted of violence or sexual offences, released on license since the Prison Act commenced, please provide details of their sentence and time served before release.
On to the Honourable Minister for Health, Care and Justice.
Mr. Speaker, I will answer this question together with questions 66 to 74.
Question number 66, the Honourable D.A. Peterson.
Mr. Speaker, in relation to all offenders convicted of violent or sexual offences released on license with the Prison Act commenced, please state whether there have been any cases where an offender has been released on license without notifying the victim or their family.
Question number 67, the Honourable D.A. Peterson.
In relation to all offenders convicted of violent or sexual offences released on license with the Prison Act commenced, please state in how many cases offenders have been released with conditions on their license
designed to protect the victim or their family. Question number 68, the Honourable D.A.C. Council. In relation to all offenders convicted of violent or sexual offences with Eastbourne License to the Freedom Act Committee, how many instances of breach of license conditions have there been? Question 69, the Honourable D.A.C. Has the Law Commission considered reform of the parole system for the government? Has the Law Commission considered reform of the parole system or the government invited victims to provide services to them about their experiences of the parole system? Question number 70, Marvel D.A. Keating. Since the Prison Act commenced on the 23rd September 2011, how many victims of violent or sexual offences or all the families of such victims have been asked to provide representation or the evidence to the parole board to seek a federal one of that act prior to their advice to the minister? Question number 71, the Honourable D.A. Keating. In relation to the previous questions on the number of victims of violent or sexual offences who have been asked to provide representation or the evidence to the parole board to seek a federal one of the Prison Act, please provide details of the length of sentence and the time served before that offender was asked to be released. Question number 72, the Honourable D.A. Keating. Since the Prison Act commenced, how many victims of violent or sexual offences or the families of those victims have not been asked to provide the documentation or the evidence to the parole board pursuant to federal law that act prior to the board's advice to the minister? Question number 73, the Honourable D.A. Keating. In relation to the previous question on the number of victims of violent or sexual offences that have been asked to provide representation for the evidence to the parole board to speak to every one of the prisoners, we provide a breakdown of the offences for which the offenders were convicted. Question number 74, the Honourable D.A. Keating. In relation to victims of violent or sexual offences or the families of such victims that have not been asked to provide representation, all the need for the parole is to see a schedule one of that act prior to the board's advice to the minister. We provide a breakdown of all the offence, the related sentence, and see time served before they were ultimately released on last. Thank you, the Honourable Minister for Health, Care and Justice.
Mr. Speaker, I now hand over to the Honourable Gentleman a schedule which includes the sentences imposed on prisoners in relation to violent and sexual offences who were released on parole license since the Prison Act 2011 commenced, together with a length of sentence served. The number of offenders convicted of violent or sexual offences and released on parole license since the Prison Act commenced is 29 for violent offences and 4 for sexual offences. Overall, parole licenses in Hamilton focus on managing all risks and predominantly risk of harm to the public. The parole board routinely applies specific conditions in all cases involving sexual offences and in cases in which a specific victim is assessed to be at risk of violence from the offender. The number of breach of license conditions for offenders convicted of a set of violent or sexual offences releasing licenses driven at commencement date. The breach of license conditions have all been in respect of offenders convicted for violence-related offences. None of these breaches have been in relation to any incidents involving victims of their original index offences. Mr. Speaker, government has stated on numerous occasions, in particular in answers to questions 354 of 17, 53 of 18, 569 of 18, and press releases 73 of 2017, the Law Commission comprised the leading experts in their respective fields to start with scrutinising the Prison Act. In particular, the person who is sentenced to serving a sentence of imprisonment becomes eligible for release from parole and will be considering all options, especially how to protect the victims of crime and the general public. The Law Commission will issue a consultation document for the public to make their intentions on the proposed reforms to the Prison Act. Mr. Speaker, the government is not able to answer questions 66 and 70 to 74 as the parole board of an independent statutory body. Mr. Speaker, the further honourable judgment of the Prison Act, specifically section 52 of section 11, quotes states that without prejudice to the jurisdiction of the courts, in the exercise of their functions,
the Parole Board and its members shall not be subject to the direction or control of any other person or authority.
Mr. Speaker, just in relation to the last part of the Honourable Minister's answer. Now, that relates to the question about representation provided by victims and their families to the parole board on the parole process. And whether in fact representations have been sought in all these cases, with representations have been given. Now, I understand, Mr. Speaker, that the parole board is an independent body and its main function is to advise the minister, one of its duties, to advise the minister on the release of prisoners. And the minister has no desire, and indeed no one has suggested, that this particular minister or any minister may take pressure on the parole board to act in a particular way. But does it not think that it is important, as the minister suggested, to monitor the working of the prisoner and indeed to monitor at how far and to what extent our victims and their families asked to provide their views, so far as that is commensurate with the Act, because that is not interfering. If I were the Minister for Justice, these are the types of questions that I would ask to inform myself as to whether the system is working well or the system is not working well. So that is the method, not interfering. And it seems, if it is possible and indeed appropriate for him to inform himself in that way, that therefore he has a duty to inform the Parliament when the Parliament asks somebody in Parliament asks the question. The Honourable Gentleman should know that I do keep a close eye in all areas that are my responsibility. However, the Parole Board is, by virtue of his act, an independent statutory board. And he says that keeping myself informed or thinking that the Parole Board take representations from the victim or the family is not interference. I'm not saying that it is interference, but the act in which he talked to the South and which was enacted did not set the threshold so high. It says direction. And for me, direction means that I'm not even to tell the parole board I'm directing you to keep the presentation. And therefore, I take that duty as Minister and also as Minister of Justice very seriously. And because the wording is that cannot be publishing a direction of anybody, that would include myself, and therefore I'm not even going to get caught in the mere suggestion that I may have given a direction in breach of the relevant section, section 52 of the Prison Act. Now, having said all of that, do I think that the Prison Act requires reform? I think that the Honourable Gentleman knows, without getting into the debate we had outside of the House, that the Law Commission is looking at the Prison Act, and it is looking, in particular, at the first order of business on the point, or rather at the point at which a prisoner ought to be eligible for parole. So the Honourable Gentleman knows by way of answering going into the House, and also by way of press release, that the Law Commission, which is comprised of, apart from being comprised of eminent professionals in their field, is also comprised of the Lord Supreme Magistrate and of a Supreme Court justice. So the question of parole is being looked at very carefully and thoughtfully by the Law Commission. And in fact, we are ready to make an announcement. And I have it for two reasons. The first being that we are finding down the language for the questions, for the press notice, but also because I have these questions before the House. And I thought it was only proper, but given that I will be answering them today, to wait with the announcement, not the announcement, until I answer these questions for today.
So, in short order, the answer to this question, the Law Commission, not just myself or my own, the Law Commission, which includes myself, is looking at the question of soil and is looking at the question of the function that the parole board takes into account when deciding the question of soil. Thank you very much.
I understand perfectly that under the law, the minister can't direct the parole board to do the laws in the particular section are essentially there in order to make it clear that the minister doesn't direct the parole board to act in any particular way. And that is understood. And it's also understood, subject to criticism as to how two things, that's another matter altogether, I don't want to mix one thing with the other, that the government is undertaking any overview of parole legislation. But you see, I have to come back, and it's a way that I have a lot of respect for him, and I think that after all the ministers there, he's one of the most competent ministers in the government coming. You know, I say that without hesitation. But he's not, but he's got the he's been evasive in the way that he's answering the question, because he knows that I'm focusing on a very specific issue, and that is representation, the number of representations that have been made by victims or their families to the parole board. It's a number, not no details, it's a number. And the number of cases in which the parole board is not sought for representation. And I realize that there may be a different opinion in terms of interpretation. But one provision in the schedules is quite clear that there is that representations are sought. I know that representations are asked on a particular aspect. I know because I can set methods, so I know that representations are sought. What I'm asking is for whether the government knows the numbers of times that the parole board has asked for representations of victims and their families, and also the number where they have not fallen. Because that is absolutely the very tremendously important. From the government's point of view and from the Law Commission's point of view, informing themselves as to whether the system is working well or is not working well. It is also important for us here because we are tasked in a democracy with holding the government to account. And much as I, don't actually let go of this particular minister, because I know that he is a minister that, on the whole, that is what his job very well. But, you know, that's our job. It's our job to hold the government to account. And again, I have to come back to this. Does he know, at least coming out of this, does he know the numbers, in terms of the number of times that victims of their families have been asked to provide their representation, and the number in terms of cases where they've not been asked to provide representation. He must know that. And if he knows, he's got, in my perspective, of view, an obligation, a duty to provide that information across the field of the House to. Mr. Speaker, I know what the job is being an MP is. I was one for 4 years. So you don't need to tell me the job description. I understand when I talk to you, you're to ask me questions and you're to write in for the information. But if I don't take that on analogy, when I was Minister for Commerce, I would have asked questions about the trade management board because it's an independent board. I never once thought to give them anything other than the reporting they may require to do their job. This even more important insofar as the community needs to know that the parole board is totally independent and entirely free of any sort of direction from the ministry. The community needs to be comfortable, and that's the case. Otherwise, you will say, as he has in the press release, that it would be lobbying. And you may recall that he said that in a press release in 2017. So let's keep the pointific out of the process. I have to tell them, Mr. Speaker, because if you did actually say to me that the Law Commission is taking a little bit of time, it's taking a little bit longer because I'm not going to get into that.
upon the speaker. He did introduce the act himself. Right? So, you see the theme of these issues at the time of the government to Parliament. It used to be said, given that he's going to criticize the Royal Commission for not having it done for a quicker, there was no discussion during the course of the introduction of the Prison Act about the point at which a Prison Act ought to be eligible for parole. Why did he debate it? It should not have been a performance of his mind as a question of policy. Know that this is an issue for him was not just political. This is the reason why I'm answering him in the way that I am, which is not to work into a political fight. This is a delicate, sensitive issue that affects people directly, and therefore we must treat it with the seriousness that it deserves. The Law Commission has met, I think, 4 or 5 times. It has not been an easy job to decide, first of all, the point at which a prisoner ought to be eligible for parole, and that has required not just discussion among the Law Commission, but also in respect of the evidence that it sought. And it sought evidence from the Parole Board, from the Convention Services, and from the Her Majesty's Prison. So, yes, ordinarily I like to do things quicker, but on this occasion it is not proceeding quick thing, but ultimately we are deciding on the constitutional right of a person to be deprived of their liberty, even someone who has committed a criminal offence for which he is serving a prison sentence. So this is not the usual run-of-the-mill policy. This is clearly stuff that has required legal input and questions of constitutional importance. Therefore, I'm not being evasive. I can assure you I'm not being evasive. So if I am going to give strength, and I'm going to mean what I say, that the parole board is independent, the honourable gentleman knows, and I think I'm going to suggest this to you in the course of a telephone conversation, that because the parole board is an independent body, and if he wants information from them, he's perfectly able to write to them directly. I'm not going to substitute the work of the parole board for myself. I need to be very clear about my role as the Justice Minister and what the role of the Parole Board is. And my role as Justice Minister is simply to accept the advice of the Parole Board. If I disagree, I bring it back. If I still disagree, I bring it to the Supreme Court. To enter into another discussion for me would be a breach of standing orders because we're in fact debating the fine points of the law. And as Mr. Speaker will notice, I have stayed clear of quoting the section and saying why this is a legal interpretation. So you can believe me when I tell you that I'm not being evasive. It is simply that I do not think it was the role of the minister to answer the question that was asked in respect of the number of victims that have given statements to the parole board. But I have answered him the questions which I thought were appropriate for me. I've asked about the number of victims in the family who have been asked to provide representation to the parole board and the number who have provided. Now, let me ask the question, the last question I'm going to ask you. Does he know the number? Mr. Speaker, I know of the cases that have come before me. The question is, does he know the number of victims and families in all these cases, the number that have been asked to provide their representation as part of the parole board? Mr. Speaker, he was Minister for Justice during the time, so he would have the numbers during his time. I know in respect of the people that have come before me. That is all. Mr. Speaker, indeed. But because I see to do this with the practice, unfortunately, in the same way, I see that as a good level. I see, or in his colleagues, because of course he cannot admit he can see himself from his colleagues out to his left, Mr. Nguyen, who is Minister for Justice before him, therefore it's the government, he must, as a government, have the figures post-December 2011. Therefore, if you want to win me, as I said, it will be the last question that I have, but in the last of the topic, he knows the figure, that he must have the duty to
call value meal is that people, when I ask it, as part of the democratic process in this parliament. I agree with them because the parole board is a statutory independent body and are perfectly able to speak for themselves.
Question number 75, the Honourable Ms. B.D. Hassan.
Has government been made aware of the excess supply of benzodiazepines locally, and if so, is there a reason why such excessive amounts raised alarm bells by suppliers?
Answer the Honourable Minister for Health, Care and Justice. Mr. Speaker, yes, the huge benefit advice of an excess supply by the manufacturer. Benzodiazepines are sedatives recommended for short-term treatment only because they can quickly become addictive. They are used in a variety of disorders, such as managing panic attacks, insomnia, as well as the muscle spasms and in back pain and for alcohol withdrawal. It has been recognized for some time that it is generally inappropriate to use these drugs like, for example, Xanax and Valium, going forward. Not only does the effect of the drug decrease and require higher doses for the same impact, that will create dependence. Younger people, this will lead to confusion and falls. When the drug is stopped, users can experience severe withdrawal symptoms such as insomnia, irritability, tension, panic attacks, thermal stress, and poor concentration, nausea, palpitations, headaches, muscle aches, and sometimes even seizures and psychotic reactions. Withdrawal can be difficult since the initial symptoms for which the drug is prescribed might return, made worse by the symptoms for the withdrawal from the withdrawal itself. Some people are therefore reluctant to stop the drugs. For these reasons, the tool should be granted and guided by clinicians who can help patients cope with any symptoms. A doctor with special expertise in this area has commenced new service to address this, has been informed of the symptoms of the greatest level of addiction, and is planning to reduce this in a managed way. Since the dedicated to the higher rate of use than is ideal for a community such as ours, the DHA has carried out an audit to examine the use of the drug water, with a view to improving the effectiveness of these drugs and managing a process of withdrawal for those who have been using them for longer than is optimal. The DHA is also looking to see how big a problem this is in the private sector, where the ability to influence behavior in the sector is limited. Mr. Speaker, DHA regards this as an important health issue and is taking measures to address it. All prescribers in the primary care centre are also being informed individually of the patients who are on long-term benzodiazepines so they can take steps to reduce the dependence in a managed way.
Thank you for that detailed explanation, Mr. Speaker. Is government satisfied that these sales have been based on prescription only and not over the counter supply?
Mr. Speaker, there is nothing on the information that has been provided to indicate that. The question just touched me a little bit. I'm surprised by the question, so I don't have that information, but there is nothing to indicate that that is the case.
So, Mr. Speaker, I ask because there has been a large dependency on this drug over decades as a voter, and I ask the minister himself again whether there will be some sort of policies or guidelines in order to wean patients off the dependency. And has this plan already been set in motion? Are people already reaping the benefits of these guidelines or policies as a result of their new health information issues?
I think the Honourable Lady may recall that last year we announced the start of Dr. Simone Taylor, who is a GP with special interest in alcohol and drug addiction, and she has carried out the audit on behalf of the DHA. And we have been able to identify quite clearly the patients who should be managed carefully to relieve themselves from the dependence on these particular drugs.
As I said tonight, I'm going to quote as my answer. This doctor has been tasked with managing those car plans. All prescribers, in the final car center, have been informed individually of the patients who are long term on these plans. So all the GPs know which patients are on these plans, so they can take the steps that need to do in terms of managed care. So to the short, yes, there's been a full audit, yes, steps have already been taken, and it should assuage the overall major concern the fact that we have a special interest GP for the patient that is managing the patient.
They are less ready to face the perhaps, the question in court of God, if you could allocate priorities to the agenda of prison, of drug services in prison, because of course it has a massive domino effect on people when they come out, and from my dealings with many prisoners who come out, they are deeply unsatisfied and feeling very lost about their treatment in terms of drug therapy addiction whilst they've been inside.
Well, Mr. Speaker, just to say that I don't think it's fair to say that we have zero support. In fact, we've had 72 inmates in the course of last year in hundreds of drugs counselling in prison. And the information that has been provided to me says that these inmates have received counselling exclusively in relation to drugs and dependency. So we only have 72 inmates who have received that counselling support. In addition to this, there is also the work done on the child step program. So I don't think it would be fair to characterize the support given at zero. Like always, any service provided by government, I thought that we could include any service currently provided. But I think it would be to some of the perspectives to the two councillors who are providing the service currently, so that they're having support work further. And at the table of the lady, I'd be happy to look into this answer further.
Like I said, I'm in no disrespectful service to the two counselors. The drug addiction is a very specific disease, and therefore perhaps the two counselors involved who are there, who are not specialized drug counselors, may be feeling disrespected themselves because they're not getting the support. And so, it's nothing to do with disrespecting them. The issue is whether there are dedicated drug counselors, whereas maybe these other two counselors are dealing with a myriad of many other issues going on in prison. And if I can just ask, when the minister talks about the 12-step process, what actually happens? If that is the case, if they are receiving the 12-step process, can I ask if there is follow-up on that process once they have had the closure and they have come out of prison in order for them obviously not to relapse? Is there a follow-up after they have come out?
Mr. Speaker, I'm afraid one of the lady counselors is wrong. I would characterize the council as zero support. I don't think that's the one that's expected. If there's zero support, then that means that the first two inmates and the two drug counselors don't have any support. It can be only one thing or the other. But I don't want to dwell on that. But I've explained to the honorable lady, one of the counselors received referrals solely in respect of prisoners with drugs and other dependency issues. In addition to that, there is work that is conducted both on the 12-step work with prisoners, and there is also a comprehensive program entitled Fighting Pain, which also relates to drugs and alcohol addiction. So there are, from the information that I have, three stages. There is the individual counseling, there is also the 12-step program, and there is also the Fighting Pain strategy. And Mr. Speaker, I remind one of the ladies that governments are hired as looking with special interest in drug addiction and alcohol dependency, and she is also involved in a system of domestic prison in respect of drug counseling. And here, what she said is that there more being able to be done. I think a name of the sort from which she said that, and I've already told her that I am happy to look at what else can be done. But what I'm telling you is that we cannot characterize it as zero support. So I'm telling you that perhaps more can be done, but not whether it's the zero support of inmates who need to discuss drug counseling and drug dependency. The Senate will stand in order the Honourable Chief Minister. Mr. Speaker, I have the honour to understand the Minister of the Speech.
Those in favour? Those against? Motion to the Honourable Minister for the Environment, Energy, Climate Change and Education.
Mr. Speaker, I have the honour to move the local standard in my name to the fellow. This note This House notes that Parliament agencies are internationally recognized for their instance being used by Parliament, councils, and local authorities, predominantly in the UK, Canada, Australia, and the USA, to publicly declare concern over the Intergovernmental Panel on Climate Change findings, which recognize the adverse global impact of the changing climate. The declaration also serves as a commitment to take urgent action and aspire towards carbon neutrality. It's a call to action that engages the entire community, and is not just about the practical actions that a government might take. Humans have already caused irreversible climate change, the impact of which has been felt around the world. Global temperatures have already increased by 1 degree Celsius from pre-industrial levels, and the solid carbon dioxide levels are about 400 parts per million, and far exceed the 350 parts per million deemed to be a safe level for humanity. In order to reduce the chance of runaway global warming and limit the effects of climate breakdown, it is imperative that we as a species reduce our carbon dioxide equivalent emissions from the current 6.5 pounds per person per year to less than 2 times as soon as possible. Individuals cannot be expected to make this reduction on their own. Society and government need to respond to make low carbon living easier and make it the new norm. The government has already shown foresight and leadership when it comes to addressing this year's climate breakdown, including as a replacement of the diesel car generation by the less polluting energy, and by further being further committed to increasing the use of renewable sources of energy to at least 20% by 2020. Society and young people in particular around the world are asking governments to act on climate change. Recognizing that such initiatives need to be urgently stepped up, and telling us that the world is on track to overshoot the Paris Agreement 1.5% limit before 2050. The IPCC's special report on global warming of 1% degree centigrade describes the enormous harm that a 2 degree rise is likely to cause compared to the 1.5 degree rise, and told us that limiting global warming to 1.5 degrees Celsius may still be possible with ambitious action by national and sub-national authorities, civil society, the private sector, indigenous peoples, and local communities. Governments around the world are responding by declaring a climate emergency and committing resources to address this emergency. I'm further recognizing that it is important for the residents of Gibraltar that we commit to carbon neutrality as quickly as possible. This House therefore believes that all governments, national, regional, and local, have a duty to limit the negative impact of climate breakdown. The consequences of global temperature rising above the 1.5 degrees Celsius are so severe that preventing this from happening must be humanity's main priority. Bold climate action can deliver economic benefits in terms of new jobs, economic savings and market opportunities, as well as improved well-being for people worldwide. And therefore resolve to 1. Declare a climate emergency. 2. Pledge to make the world a carbon neutral by 2030. 3. Pledge to reduce emissions by 50% by 2035. 4. Work with other governments in the UK family, including the Devolved Administration, the UK Overseas Charities, and the Crown Dependency, to determine and implement best practice methods to limit global warming to less than 1.5 degrees. 5. Work with partners across the world and in the region to deliver this new goal to all relevant strategies. And 5. And I have a minor amendment here, Mr. Speaker, come back to Parliament by the end of 2019 with a climate emergency plan, which will include a carbon reduction plan. Mr. Speaker, the Earth climate has never stood still. There are cycles and there are events in the millennial history of any planet with consequences to the climate upon it. We all know about the receding ice sheets and glaciers, rising the sea level that threaten communities and coastal regions around the world, from documentaries and increasingly from the news channels, so I do not intend to go through that again. But until the last 200 years, all these changes have been due to natural processes and not to the activity of just one species, ours. Our impact upon the face of the Earth is now undeniable. The debate is clearly older. It was over a long time ago, but somehow it persisted until quite recently. When this government brought Vice President Al Gore to DeVolta in 2012, there was a campaign even in DeVolta to question climate reality. Well, what we were doing was trying to get DeVolta to catch up with this reality. We took another quick look at Santa. Carbon dioxide in the atmosphere up from 357 parts per million in 1993 to over 400 parts per million, the highest since record began. Average temperatures worldwide were 1 degree higher in 2018 than the average in the 1900s. In 2018, 62 million people were affected by climate events, and 35 million people were made homeless by floods. In North Japan and the United States, 1,200 people died through heat waves and fires, many unseasonal. In Gibraltar, severe weather events are becoming more common, with severe storms occurring at least once every year for the past 10 years. According to a United Nations report this week, the activities that lead to climate change, like deforestation for timber or the food industry, and their effects, like flooding, temperature rises, habitat loss, desynchronizing of nature, especially of migrant species, risk the extinction of a million species with which we currently share the planet. To drill a little deeper into this, between May and July 2018, a 5 million square kilometer area was affected by extra hot days. That, Mr. Speaker, is 22% of populated and agricultural areas in the Northern Hemisphere. According to research presented recently at the Earth Food Sciences Union Conference in Vienna, the extent of the area affected is such that it would not have occurred without managing climate change. Now, extreme weather cost the global economy over $500 billion in damages in 2017 and 2018. Wall Street and other financial centers are now measuring up the risk of extreme weather to assets. Maybe, Mr. Speaker, that is the language that former climate change skeptics need to understand. For too long, the concerns about climate change have been heard in the relatively closed circles of scientists and environmentalists, with the rest of the world, including the business community and organizations, keeping conveniently silent. But this is funny. Just recently, the UK's largest money manager, Legal and General Investment Management, has informed the claim that the world is facing a climate catastrophe and that businesses around the world must urgently address it. They say that if they remain ignorant of this crisis, they face shareholders refusing to back them anymore. A new report published by LGIM has revealed that they have voted against a record number of companies in 2018, and the factor for this was climate change. The fact says that climate change was an, I quote, ongoing priority, and that this is increasingly factored into capital allocation decisions. As part of its climate impact pledge, in 2018, LGIM announced that it will not hold those large global companies in the Future World Fund. Where such companies are seen to take insufficient action on climate risks, LGIM will also vote against the shares of their vote across the entire equity holding. This follows the British Gas Corporation shares, granting the membership with US trade group American Steel and petrochemical manufacturers over climate change policy. ASPM and Shell do not align on a number of issues, including the Paris Agreement and carbon prices. And other companies, such as Coca-Cola and Unilever, who have also contributed significantly to the climate crisis, are finding that they have no choice but to change through pressure from both consumers and investors. Mr. Speaker, the impact of climate change has compelled governments and corporations to act. Catalyzed by the Paris Agreement, governments around the world are putting policies in place to limit the global rise in temperatures to 2 degrees and preferably as close to 1.5 degrees as possible. The actions undertaken by individual countries must deliver a collective transition to a low carbon economy. To achieve this, carbon emissions have to decline by 45% from 2010 levels over the next decade in order to reach net zero by 2050. This requires a massive reallocation of capital. It is clear now that those companies and industries that fail to adjust to this new world will fail. So, to England recently warned of the climate change threat to the financial system. He said, "The prime responsibility for climate policy will continue to sit with government, and the private sector will determine the success of the adjustment. But as financial policymakers and prudential supervisors, we cannot ignore the obvious risk before our eyes." Consider this move is finally taking hold. It is late. It should not have taken so long. But this is a world whose economy is not governed by those who are in contact with nature, but by them very to understand the real priorities of humanity's survival. The stakes are high, but if a climate-driven need to moment is to be avoided, the financial sector must act. So the figure, many have run out of tension, and this has been expressed in the streets. Young people are working out of school to strike for climate around the world, including the World Cup. Hundreds of people were arrested recently during a protest organized by Extinction Rebellion, a group demanding that the UK set legally binding targets to reduce carbon emissions to net zero by 2025. The UK's current position is to cut carbon emissions by 80% by 2050, although this will almost certainly be reviewed downward. This motion commits to carbon neutrality by 2035. As the Governmental Panel on Climate Change made clear last year, limiting warming to the safer level of 1.5 degrees requires the world to fix net zero carbon emissions by about 2050. So we have to aim for better if we have a chance of achieving it. European countries, including France, Sweden, Norway, and Portugal, as well as nations elsewhere, such as Costa Rica, the Marshall Islands, and New Zealand, have all tried to hit the target. Some by 2050, some earlier. The Swedish Parliament came into force last year, demanding net zero emissions to an 85% reduction in domestic greenhouse gas by 2045. The remaining 15% will need to come from adoption, probably planting trees, removing carbon from the air, or carbon exits, with the Swedish government commission examining the option. Government is following all these guidelines as a development strategy, which is committed to report by the end of the year to this Parliament. Before then, Mr. Speaker, I intend to bring a bill for a climate change act to the House, which will set targets and reporting obligations, as I have mentioned previously here. Mr. Speaker, we have a real chance in developing to achieve carbon neutrality. Already, we have reduced emissions from power generation by 21% since 2013. LNG, which produces approximately 25% less carbon than diesel, will produce a third of that. We are committed to tackling emissions from traffic and shipping, and we do not have the methane producing power to deal with, often one of the greatest obstacles to carbon neutrality. Commitments by government include those mentioned by the Chief Minister in last year's budget speech, and having no vehicles fully fueled. Other than hybrids, Mr. Speaker, to be registered by 2030 and all electric vehicles by 2035. We are planting more trees, replacing any that are removed to ensure always a net gain greenery, and will be further encouraging green roofs and green walls. Progress on renewables and development has been slow, and we certainly move much faster. We continue to look at developing sea carrier technology and nature friendly wind generation investments. But even with the expected increase in solar power, I am confident that the aim of 20% in 2020 remains achievable. We have made tremendous progress over the past few years in achieving green efficiency in business. This is our standard condition in all climates, and most new buildings are achieving energy efficiency ratings close to level A. It is no longer such a struggle to convince developers and contractors about the measures needed to achieve sustainable buildings. A sustainable construction system also needs a feature. I am pleased to say that my discussions with the developers at Victoria King have been extremely positive, and we are aiming for a carbon neutral development at the very least. This is the way we need to go if we are going to see further development. And together, the world does not have all the answers yet. But technology is moving. Many of the key tools are untested at large scale, in particular capturing and storing carbon emissions from power stations and industrial processes, and on the atmosphere. Without ways to actively capture carbon dioxide, effectively creating negative emissions to balance out the positive ones, it will be impossible to achieve global net zero. But to verify the harmony and developing technologies and grab them as soon as they become available and viable. This is that declaring a climate emergency must do more than just wait. Nothing much has been done globally or in Gibraltar, and the declaration which I hope will pass unanimously in this house today will be a call to all of us here and in the rest of our community to not stand in the way of doing what has to be done. It's because the ESC is forced to get a full strike on the publication of the text of this motion, it is what is a useful summary of what they see as a challenge to overcome. The head of course was forming directly by both of the full strike petition to the Chief Minister and the statement. In the representation, there is a call for public debate, which is, of course, already happening. It includes this debate, it includes the recent World Health Conference, it includes the distributors, and much more. In the very back of the end of 2011, there has been no significant public debate. The public debate started with the eyeball debate. Question, as I said, that some, it's so important in retrospect to make an impact and drive it on home. But I know, Mr. Speaker, that the ESP agree with me when I say that public debate is not enough. So, thanks to the regional situation, how so much of the economy of the day depends on fossil fuels. That's why the nation commits to showing regional leadership and leadership elsewhere in the UK family, including the Ocean Charity. And the Gibraltar is being listened to, a tweet by UN Oceans Ambassador and friends of Gibraltar USQ, and this nation gained nearly 3,000 retweets and likes in just a few days. Gibraltar has most of the countries. We need to continue to work on reducing this dependence. The American delivery to gas is one step in this transition. A hugely important step, Mr. Speaker, and we must keep on. Some measures are easier than others. For example, our water desalination plant has recently had major replacements to equipment, which will increase their efficiency tremendously with a significant drop in the use of power and hence of carbon emissions from producing our drinking water. A bunkering and solar fuel to vehicles is still important economically. To implement an effective transition, we must work with industry to reduce reliance on fossil fuels. When the use of LNG as a fuel both in shipping and in vehicles would be another important step. The use of hybrid cars as a step to fully electric vehicles and the rolling out of charging points also need to be part of the strategy. We must continue our work to find electric buses that will suit our heritage and our topography. In this, the STP people plays and will continue to play in the full path. Moving into the green economy and making Gibraltar a world leader in carbon trading using blockchain technology and riding on the strength of our digital legislation can play a tremendous part in an economic transition that will fuel our energy transition too. Must be seen as a recognition by the Parliament as representative of the people as a crisis facing the earth. It is a call to environmental arms. We need to question how we do things. We need to change potential decisions that will be taken economically in the short term to those that make long term sustainable sense. All of us here and all of us out there need to do this. And not just to be eating less meat and switching at life, but that too. Those of us who speak will make and influence policy in public and private sectors need to think carefully each and every time, and to do next time something different from what we would have done the last time. To speak the world is in the midst of a climate emergency, and I call on this house to recognize this and to commit to making a difference. I commend this motion to the House.
I now propose a question in the terms of the motion moved by the Honourable the Minister for the Environment, Energy, Climate Change and Education. The Honourable Lord Jammer.
Mr. Speaker, it is absolutely right that this House joined the Library Parliament, political bodies, organizations around the world, and in the water, to declare a climate emergency. For there is no doubt that our climate is changing. But global temperatures are rising, and the base of the accompanying rise of sea levels will have a severe impact on the future of mankind. We must make every effort to try to repair and reverse the ultimate effects of climate change. The overall targets set out in this motion, challenging though they are, must be seen as the minimum objective of the Kyoto economy. If elected as the government of the GSC to pursue those targets, in opposition, we will support governments in achieving those targets. But let's be bold and brave in developing and publishing commitments of how those targets can be achieved. The government will need to have foresight and leadership on climate breakdowns by switching from diesel to LNG. And although the fuel LNG will enhance local air quality, it does nothing with regard to the global climate crisis that is being recognized around the world. We have urged the government to review this plan, with the motion to allow the magistrate of this opposition to support the motion. But sadly, the government has refused, and by consequence, failed in seeking unanimity on certain important issues. Consequently, we shall be abstaining from the motion, given we agree with the rest of the motion. Carbon dioxide is undoubtedly the greatest contributor to the insulating effect finding taking place in our atmosphere, and controlling emissions is vital. We are reminded in the motion of the government's foresight with respect to the power generation and the upcoming shift to LNG. But this is not a credible achievement when it comes to global warming and the government's compound is flawed. Reasoning by suggesting the LNG is the future. Energy is methane. Between 1.5% and 3% of the methane produced extensively to the atmosphere in the production and transportation process. By increasing the demand for methane, we are partly to encouraging the increase of its production. Methane is estimated to contribute about 28% of the global warming gases in the atmosphere. But now we use the solar poisons as a greenhouse gas. About 80 times more potent than carbon dioxide over a 10-year period. We cannot ignore this fact, and we certainly not congratulate ourselves as we can, but it is thought out that this industry is being carried in the context of this motion. There has been little progress in increasing the amount of power generation renewable sources. We keep getting these power of objectives, but these are not materialized. In 2016, when the minister asked what proportion of the global energy was produced from renewable sources, the answer is 0.05%. 3 years down the line, and that figure remains almost static. Let's develop and publish a roadmap that can be unanimously agreed with short, medium, and long-term initiatives. Committing this house long-term. We need a plan and declarations by the form of work list. To have foresight and leadership would have been to have achieved a radically alternative non-fossil dependent form of energy and crisis. This government has pledged not to raise an occasion in order to prove a political point. I often criticize that during the My Budget speech this year. The time has come for political parties to disregard votes and commit to policies which will prove unpopular. There is no time to wait for the end of the year to implement policies which can be introduced today. Next action is staggered removal of the subsidy of electricity in this budget and invest that revenue in the ring-fenced climate breakdown budget. Recommend legislation in a more punitive manner to those, particularly corporate, involved in the ship repair yard and bunkering and raise revenue for a climate budget too. Let's go away with the free parking and midtown and focus on greener methods of transport. Let's bring back the cap initiative for hydrogen, which was reduced from 1,000 to 250 pounds. Let's introduce construction values, which will give back to the community, especially at the height of construction that's been planned. Let's introduce subsidies for renewable energy initiatives in private property. Let's have greater communication between local organizations to share resources. Let's increase the price of people. As for carbon dioxide, what are we doing? Diesel is still incredibly cheap at our price. This relationship has risen under this government, and we habits that are established in this nation and carefully planned and effective way of our own. Let's have the courage to admit we have failed our start and we must do better. With our planet, our culture, and our future, depend on it.
Speaker, I have not originally intended to speak in this debate. However, in order to inform myself better about the climate emergency, I did attend the World Earth Day at the University last week with the Minister of Earth, and I also attended the ESG event last night. And I think it is a lot of deep regret that we are in official opposition are not in a position to support the motion because of the way it has been drafted. And the Minister knows this. The Minister knows that if these politically biased manners are being removed, we in this Tribal Council will have no problem supporting the announcement. And you're about to shake his head, but he knows that. And you see that in terms of the reaction that this House is committing itself to, I've already pointed out to the Minister that post 6th of Celsius, this House is to take over Roman to come back to itself for a vote. And how are we going to come back for a vote proper? What is the mechanism? If the Minister is serious, what is the problem in post 6th? Is this House involved by a set up or appoint a commission? Or perhaps it's going to be a select committee to take evidence and then report back to the House? So this House cannot just have arrived at this come back to Parliament at the end of 2019. Well, the emergency time, it doesn't make sense to this speaker. I would like to explain to this House how this House is going to report back to itself. Or is it, Mr. Speaker, they can say, if you will come back to this place for the town, in which case, I would welcome that conversation. Because as it stands, Mr. Speaker, I don't see that any reason to report to anybody. So, I would welcome them to try to find out. And Mr. Speaker, in terms of the climate change act that the UK has since 2008, we're obviously a bit far off the mark. And I will welcome the draft bill when it arrives in this place, and of course the debate that follows. I will invite the Minister to engage the members in this side of the House. So we should also have input into that bill, and the House should perhaps then arrive at a position which is unanimous. And Mr. Speaker, having attended the World Health Day, one thing that struck me, which is the frustration of environmental activists who claimed that they heard it all before. They heard it all before from parliaments like this, like parliaments elsewhere. So yes, we think it's terrible, yes, we think it's a climate emergency, yes, we're going to pass motion, yes, we're going to, but nothing actually happened. So Mr. Speaker, and in case we've had again, but he knows he's there. We need to do something that is practical and seems to be practical. And one thing that I took away from the ESG meeting last night was that they felt that we in Parliament should be working together on a cross-party basis. We should. We should. We should have all together. One big party. Representing Gibraltar as a whole. What we cannot do is fall into a trap, whether intentionally or unintentionally, of making party political points just because it is there to be taken. I have told the Minister, and he knows this, that if we remove that particular paragraph, we will have no problem supporting the motion. But he doesn't. And he knows that. I mean, the ESG last night don't care whether we agree or not. They want us as a parliament to work together. How on earth are we going to do this? We can't even agree on simple motions. Yet we need to be able to. We need a mechanism. We need a mechanism in which we can come together and then agree the way forward. But we cannot have is one side of motion, but which one side will pass without any big majority anyway. Really, when you own the side of the House right there, it's not part of the emotion. It makes no difference whatsoever. But if we really want to make a difference in the community,
we have to work together to find a possible solution. I suggest, Mr. Speaker, that if they were genuine in their intention, they would invite the House to the select committee in order to report back to the House of what is the best way to achieve these targets. And Mr. Speaker, the intention is there on the table. We in this side of the House are not adverse to that. They're okay, they're going to take the credit for everything. So be it. I say this now. I say this now, Mr. Speaker. It's not all a wonderful lack of trying from this side of the House. And Mr. Speaker, the environmentalists who are watching this today, not quite that much advanced, hopefully, from when we take them today, will be shaking their heads at us and saying, can't you guys get your act together? And Mr. Speaker, I say it again. It is not for want of trying from the side of the House. I invite the Minister to think seriously about protecting the committee. You'll have to be in this motion and put things in another one. And Mr. Speaker, in terms of what my honourable friend said about putting his money where his mouth is, he needs to consider whether he needs a budget for whatever maximum he thinks he needs to change. Because invariably there will be a cost. And that cost, I think, has to be thought about and come up with whatever realistic measures that we think in this case are necessary, which is the end, which I think, and we all agree, are necessary. But if you think of what Mr. Cannon do is come to this House with a motion singing his own praises, what is he trying to declare a climate emergency? Mr. Speaker, that was simply not to do. I think, Mr. Speaker, I regret, again, that we in this side of the House cannot give the man support we'd all like to. And Mr. Speaker, the vote for that they say is for the not government.
The Honourable Madeleine has an hour. Previously, I was waiting to see whether a member from the government was going to contribute. I did not expect that anyone was going to do so, and that's why I called on the Honourable Roy Clinton. But if an honourable member of government wishes to speak now, then I can do so. There should be a problem. So, the Honourable Mr. Paul Robin.
Thank you, Speaker.
Mr. Speaker, the motion being brought before Parliament today is one of critical importance to us as a people. Although this may sound alarming among people in science fiction, this is our present day reality. This is our Parliament. But we are faring very badly indeed as a generation, even though it is arguably our generation that contributed most to the state of our global environment. Mr. Speaker, the term emergency has very serious connotations indeed. The word conjures the image of a disaster of people running desperately to save lives. Most of us cannot see those things that are deemed to be so critical in our daily lives, and that makes it so much harder to be concerned. Yet, we are bombarded by constant images in the media of the effects of plastics in the ocean, our ocean, now making their way into our very soil. Of the effects of global warming of climate change, the catastrophic effects of weather, and the statistics of the effects of the environment to our health. Certainly, the most powerful energy that goes upon its own and really puts things into perspective is that of divers swimming amidst a sea of plastic, and that of seagoing turtles turning back into the ocean and able to lay their eggs in the sand on an uninhabited island in the Seychelles, their paths blocked by plastic and other debris washed up on the shore. Mr. Speaker, climate emergency is an internationally recognized declaration, and very urgent action is required if we are to divert disaster. But is there the will? Unfortunately, it seems not. Mr. Speaker, I strive to propose the view that the majority of Britons are unwilling to significantly reduce the amount they drive, and eat meat in order to combat climate change. 56% of Britons surveyed would not be willing to drive significantly less to tackle climate change. But surely, this is not something of our making. Individuals cannot be held responsible for the actions of industrialization, and we as individuals surely cannot make much of a change to the global environment. Even the whole community,
how the water is merely one drop in the ocean. And speaking to be further, no further from the truth. I asked them this day, when was the last time you caught the sea bus service? Did you walk the children to school? Did you walk to work? The speaker, you asked for a passive bag when you stopped to go to. Exactly why do you not walk with the speaker? There are too many hills. I'm made for work. It's too hot. It's too cold. It's raining. How far do you drive to get to work? How desperately do we need to use our cars to drive us children going 500 meters to school and it sits patiently in that traffic jam longer when it rains, wondering perhaps, even asking ourselves, who exactly is to blame for this traffic jam? And people we know that Gibraltar has one of the highest vehicle ownership rates in the world. Our cars are almost etched into our genetic makeup. At worst than vehicle ownership is vehicle use itself. How many of us own two or more cars per household, own two motorbikes? How many of us drive ourselves alone to work? Our dependence on the car will never change unless we are prepared to make change happen. I must admit that I am not a strong believer in the electric car, unless it comes hand in hand with the reduction of vehicles on our roads. Sure, changing a fossil fuel-powered car for an electric vehicle has very positive effects. It's a great start, but I believe that we still own two or more cars and two motorbikes when we inevitably go full electric in the future. And we still sit in that clean traffic jam and road to road, granted almost a little free, but still wondering what exactly has really changed. And people, we all have a part to play. Every little bit counts because each and every drop that falls into an ocean makes a ripple, and that ripple can potentially reach and inspire many others in its path. Will we have to look at our children to fix the mess? Will it fall on their shoulders? What legacy are we leaving them? Because children and teenagers are a massive force for change. They teach us, they inspire us, and children are respected. After all, it is the feeling he was actually caught off Sunday, whose recent visits have been causing waves, and awareness is growing as this momentum grows. The speaker of the FCPPP provided with a very powerful platform, a document that sets government policy, allowing us to make inroads to actively encourage the community to adopt more sustainable modes of transport. Easier said than done, and about as unpopular as removing a total of damage just when they are ready to fall asleep. After all, the FCPPP goes deep within the fabric of society at large, and human nature does not adapt easily to change at first. But we cannot underestimate what each of us can do in our own right, and what a contribution to the environment can be, no matter how small or how tiny. The FCPPP is nothing more than an environmental plan, a plan that sets aims and targets for the reduction of emissions to help improve air quality by tackling traffic and transport issues. It addresses car usage, encouraging the use of public transport for bicycles by improving cycling infrastructure and improving pedestrian use. It is a slow process, but certainly slow at times, but progress is already visible. A great deal of work is being done in this respect. The FCPPP has for the first time made a delve into areas considered far too risky and politically fraught with danger. The FCPPP is an easy target, pushing hard for common good, for our health and for that of our children, for the sustainability of our planet, and the effect to be possible on polling day. It is far easier to criticize and point fingers instead of the veranda to see exactly what it's all about on the ground. If there's one thing that can bring parliament together, then it must be the environment. This is not so much about differences of opinion and more about the alignment of environmental needs that the work being done can be built upon by others, no matter who sits on this side. The work being carried out today needs to be built upon, not for any other benefit other than for the good of the environment. Mr. Speaker, I believe that we have seen improvement in the way we travel in Gibraltar. Buses are fuller. More people are cycling. More people are walking, but we have a very long way to go. Solutions need to be urgently set up if we are trying to prevent global warming and its catastrophic results. I commend this motion to that.
Mr. Speaker, I welcome the call for a climate emergency. A state of emergency is called when a disaster has occurred or is imminent, and standard constitutional procedures are suspended to address the issues with immediate effect. All resources available to the government are directed to the problem area in order to restore a sense of normality, and this is done with the utmost urgency. In terms of climate change specifically, it relates to our environment and that of the planet as a whole. A state of emergency should not be declared lightly, as it brings with it a responsibility to respond emphatically and with great urgency. I believe that in this particular instance, a state of emergency is indeed pertinent, but I question the government's ability to respond appropriately. There appears to be a chronic disconnect between the pro and the plot. Mr. Speaker, as with all complex problems, the devil is in the detail and in quantifying the deliverables. Parliament and the community need to know what the government will be doing, how it will be achieving its goals, and by when. Deferring any talk of action until the end of the year when proposals will be put to Parliament does not represent the state of emergency. So how has government begun to quantify our own contribution, Mr. Speaker? The motion proposes to reduce our carbon footprint per person from 6.5 tonnes per person to 2 tonnes per person per annum. As the Honourable Minister for the Environment knows full well, this figure does not include our bunkering industry nor air travel. So we cannot afford to selectively exclude the largest contributor to our carbon footprint in our footprint reduction efforts. The need for an honest and open approach is paramount. To tackle this constructively, and while we need to remain realistic, we need to know where we are and where we want to be. Further, Mr. Speaker, the shift of emphasis from diesel to LNG for our power generation was a good move for our environment, but one that can only be used as a temporary measure, as LNG is still a fossil fuel and therefore still a contributor to global warming. Mr. Speaker, I strongly believe that the new power plant, which has taken 8 years to be delivered and is still not fully operational despite its mid-2017 target, should be used as a flexible complement to a mix of renewable sources of energy. Gibraltar, due to its size, unique circumstances, and ability to be flexible, should be looking to attract top scientists and green energy technologies from companies to roll out a mix of leading-edge technologies to best suit our purpose. So those are to be as a test case where cutting-edge technologies can be tried and if successful, rolled out across the globe. Mr. Speaker, the National Renewable Energy Action Plan for Gibraltar, produced in February 2015, details the commitment the government of Gibraltar made to the EU in return for funding received. One area tackles our commitment to green the transport sector. Despite repeated assurances, there is still a severe lack of infrastructure rolled out across Gibraltar. It is no surprise that even with a reduction of import duties, our car dealerships have not seen any noticeable increase in demand for electric vehicles. Our public transport remains woefully short and is offering as a viable alternative for personal vehicle usage. Buses remain one of our biggest pollutants, emitting a high level of PM2.5, which are being linked with respiratory illnesses as well as stroke, coronary diseases, and other such diseases. Another area shows our biggest commitment under Gibraltar's Renewable Energy Action Plan to develop a minimum of 15% of renewably sourced energy by 2020 using a mix of technologies. We are now on the verge of this deadline, and government has yet to demonstrate any tangible progress in this regard. The government has projected that this year, 2019, we will be generating 13% of our energy through renewable sources. In reality, Mr. Speaker, we generate less than 1%. Mr. Speaker, the target set were based on an output of 53 gigawatts of energy. our present and future demands will outstrip our requirements by 2020, rendering our targets even harder to meet as a percentage of the whole. The climate emergency motion has moved to raise our renewable target now from 15% to 20%, and as I said, we are close to register any significant achievement in this area. Mr. Speaker, in a recent interview, the Honourable Minister for the Environment declared that less than 1% of our energy production locally is sourced from renewables. In other words, the government has comprehensively failed to deliver on this over twofold time. What credibility can be assigned to government's renewed vigour, which has been influenced by the recent local student strike for climate action? Because both the sunburns continue to cause charge and are beginning to get through to the older generations and to those in a position of power and influence. So, quote, a direct employment. I quote, "We only talk about moving forward with the same bad ideas that got us into this mess, even when the only sensible thing to do is pull the emergency brake. You are not mature enough to tell it like it is, even that garden that we leave for our children. For way too long, the politicians and the people in power have gotten away with not doing anything to fight the climate crisis. But we will make sure that they will not get away with it any longer. We are striking because we have done our homework and they have not." Unquote. Mr. Speaker, public statements made by ministers such as government has already shown leadership in this field and talk of inspiring our community are pure bluster and really paying lip service to the single most important issue of our time. When we talk about a climate emergency, and in the same week, we learn about a humongous new reclamation project, which will last 10 years and will be bringing up pollution of all sorts, it is difficult to take this inspiration seriously. On the one hand, trees are rightfully treated as sacred, but on the other hand, pulled apart and thrown to one side in order to accommodate yet another building site. It is almost impossible to believe anything that we hear from climate, from government, on climate emergency. Mr. Speaker, the unfortunate reality is that the gears of Peterborough have unjustly failed to transpose knowledge and enthusiasm into action and policy across the board so far. Of course, the Bolsho alone is not going to solve today's crisis, but we need to play our part. I strongly urge government to bring forward its case for presenting its report to Parliament and to act seriously and responsibly in its response to the global climate crisis. Only then can we really expect to abide by a parliamentary motion or any other action plan. And further, Mr. Speaker, a cross-party vote is a must as party politics should play no part in our climatic responsibilities. We do need to work together on the climate change agenda. There are three parties, Mr. Speaker, contesting the next election, and it is election year. So in theory, all parties will be more willing to learn and listen, deliver, and promise to do. The real issue is that the environment is a problem much bigger than any political party, and the solutions need to be consulted and agreed long-term, 10 and 20 years, not just with four-year pledges that are not met. It is absolutely necessary to come with a solution together. That means reaching a consensus, even if it is minimum consensus, so that whoever comes next is responsible to carry out green pledges agreed by all, no matter what, with an emergency climate budget. People need to know, especially the younger generation, after the climate change march, that we are really going to do something about it. If it is an emergency, and it is, then it requires emergency measures, and working together is how that is achieved. Anything less than that is not good enough, Mr. Speaker. It is time to put arrogance to one side, eat some humble pie, and work together for the future of our children, whose future we are taking away without hollow words and an action. So what do we need to act now, Mr. Speaker? And this is why, despite my reservations about how and when the deliverables in this motion will materialize, I will support the motion, given that we must all stand together to support any incentive, whether poorly or well researched, and plans that target environmental consideration. Thank you, Mr. Speaker.
Any other contributors of the debate? The Honourable Speaker Minister.
Mr. Speaker, this is an important debate in the history of this House because it's the House joining an international recognition of the level of negligence that humanity has risen to the problems of the planet and the way in which we have failed to preserve the most precious inheritance we have, which is our environment, in other words, the place in which we are able to survive. And I think we sometimes fail to appreciate how fragile the environment in which we are able to survive is. Sometimes trying to understand why life does not prosper in other planets in the solar system or within our galaxy. And we realize that there are some planets which are so close to being able to sustain life, but because of a few degrees of heat or cold, are unable to do so. Well, that is the level of fragility of the environment of planet Earth that we are trying to put under the microscope today. But the whole world is slowly starting to realize that we all need to have an eye on. There are still some that deny that there is anything. So, it's absolutely right that John Cortez should be the person leading this debate on this motion, because he has a proud track record of having been raising these issues long before he's ever donned the mantle of minister or even thought of going, of allowing his children to go into politics. So, Mr. Speaker, it is also true that we can say a lot of dramatic things as members of the environmentalists for a moment have done, and those very dramatic things cannot be deemed meaningful action, because the sort of meaningful action that would follow from some of their statements is not meaningful action that anyone is prepared to see endured. So normally this is an election year, and amongst the goodies that we put up, we should be putting up goodies in respect to the environment and what the environment is going to want. This is not about goodies, this is about sacrifices. In order to see that we can do our bit very quickly and we can spend for 12 hours and we'll not produce electricity. Whether it produces an LNG or it produces some diesel, for 12 hours it will cut by half our emissions of use. But nobody would be prepared to consider that at this stage in the game. And we need to be careful that we don't over hyperbolize what it is we're going to do, and that what we do in the service of the planet and future generations is to now seriously look at how we can take the action that we need to take in a proportionate way, in an economy that operates like an island environment. In other words, we cannot be expected to be the ones that do the most in this area. Indeed, when you look at what it is that the developing countries have said to the developed world, there is a legitimacy there too. There are a nation that has been burning diesel for 20 years cannot be expected to bear the brunt of the reversal of global warming in the same way, surely, the nation that has been burning diesel for 120 years and that have the benefit of industrialization and development. So there is a balance to be done within skills of that. There is a balance to be done in order to get this right, so that the young people that came to protest to us are able to enjoy the benefit of a planet that they can inherit, ready to be able to continue to enjoy it and to redress even further the effects of climate change without having to suffer not having electricity at any time during the period of 24 hours. So the balance has to be got right. And getting that balance right is to be serious about delivering in a proportionate and proper way. So, Mr. Speaker, it was therefore absolutely right that we did not continue with the diesel or burning new power station in the area of the Upper Rock Nature Reserve that we inherited at the time that we were selected. We took a little flak for that, honorable members, and we had a very strong general election debate about this subject. And on this general election, I'm sure they were all of them, but all of them stood adopted in the manifesto commitment to stopping and to bring back to the people burning down things. Now, the debate is past and it's gone. And we won the election, we won the debate, we're implementing LNG. LNG, as the honourable member has said, and we are under no misapprehension about it, is not perfect. It's continuing to burn a fossil fuel, which continues to create heat. But it's better than burning steel, which also creates other emissions and creates different kinds of problems. So, Mr. Speaker, their option was worse than our option, although our option is not perfect. Now, this is not an attempt to win the political point, because we won that political point. We won it 3.5 years ago. And therefore, Mr. Speaker, it would be wrong not to reflect what reality in the process. It would be wrong, Mr. Speaker, not to reflect that this island economy that is not able to move immediately to renewables is doing the right thing by taking a step in the right direction. And that is to be the honourable lady is right. The energy plant has to be part of what she phrased as a flexible complement of energy producing resources, including renewable energy resources. And that is absolutely what it is. I know that this is a certain thing. She's working very hard indeed on the issue of other renewables. In terms of bringing to Gibraltar things that can be used here as a test, the Honourable Minister to also encourage and support the Israeli experiment on tidal and energy, which is exactly the sort of thing I think she is referring to, but we have been also criticised for that, so you know, we really can't win with the members of it, but it is absolutely right to have done that. Now, if you look at where we are, therefore, Mr. Speaker, what we will be able to do under the leadership of John Pottersen in respect to this particular area is to start putting in place the building blocks for this community and this society to still be able to provide for itself the energy requirements it needs, whilst at the same time ensuring that it does so insofar as possible in a way that doesn't cause greater damage to the environment. And indeed, where possible, to the rest of that. Now, Honourable Member Bolsio, in thinking I was wrong when I changed the vehicle of the official vehicle that you've been to Gibraltar from a Jaguar to a Tesla. Well, we've done this case before of how much diesel, the Jaguar burns, the emissions from it compared to the Tesla. It's mostly not perfect. You've got to dispose of the battery, you've got to charge it, and if you're not using solar or renewable sources of energy into the grid, then you're still just burning something else. And of course, it's not perfect, but it's a step in the right direction. And you're not, Mr. Dammer says, you're not doing enough to promote the use of electric vehicles. Well, demonstrating that the electric vehicle is reliable and can be used in an efficient capacity by the political determination is a step in the right direction. There are now more Tesla vehicles in Gibraltar because people have seen the Tesla function. Are there enough? There are not. Of course there are not, Mr. Speaker. But the reason that we have reduced the benefits payable in respect of hybrid versus the benefits payable in respect of electric is because there are many, many, many more hybrids now in Gibraltar. When we introduced the measure, and as part of the review of the government principles who are also bound and criticized, we introduced also the hybrid interest. We demonstrated that the hybrids were reliable. We gave a return for people who bought hybrids. Now, so many hybrids are bought in Gibraltar that the evidence tells us it is more important to now to invest for a hybrid. A lot of cars now are hybrid vehicles. And it's more important to up the amount that we give for fully electric vehicles, which is what we did. And that's exactly what I said in my budget last year, Mr. Speaker. And last year, in 2018, in consultation with June 3rd, we prohibited the registration of vehicles with purely internal combustion engines from 2030. we were roundly criticized for that as well when we speak about it. But in the United Kingdom and in other countries, the debate was to do it by 2030, not by the rest of it that were being proposed. That debate is now being brought forward there to the date that we implemented last year, 2016. That figure was 4 years away when I announced it. It's now 11 years away. The figure soon will be a decade away, and we will be into smaller figures. And vehicles are an important part of how we create global warming, and dealing with vehicles, and making people see now, with enough of a time to know how much their vehicles will be worth in the future, etc., was exactly the right thing to take. But, Mr. Speaker, the moment Mr. Gallagher says, let's do things which are unpopular, and we have to do things which are unpopular. Well, look, Mr. Speaker, we agree. I was roundly the subject of blackouts, which were negative about me, and the blackouts of Martin when we introduced the measure on plastics. That was correctly. Because we're not the sort of politicians on this side of the House of the Speaker who say that we should do things. I mean, the first part of a whistle or a blackout decided to do the opposite. We know that what we're doing is the right thing, and we're seeing it through. And there will be more reasons to come, Mr. Speaker. Despite the fact that we've been around the criticized, when we have done things which aren't popular, it would be good, Mr. Speaker, to have support from members of it when we do things which are unpopular, but which are the right thing to do. Because then we won't be acting as a parliament together. And if they say to us, look, in the wrong way, we realize nobody is right all the time. I'm not right all the time, I never pretend to be. I know that every day when I'm up, I will do things wrong, and my wife will point them all out to me. Right? Right this day. Right? I will turn around and figure. But they must not pretend that they are always right and we're the ones who are always wrong. So they say, we were wrong about the diesel power station in the upper Rock Mitchell River. Well, Mr. Speaker, then we'll be taking a step in the right direction to start to be able to do things together. But they are not committed on this subject, Mr. Speaker. And if they want to be committed on this subject, let us extend the hand of friendship to them on this subject. Let us start to be committed. And demonstrate that, Mr. Speaker, by saying, as we say, LNG, not perfect. LNG, not the solution, but a step on the road. But people work, which they have yet to recognize. They have yet to do it. Now, for the bigger, Mr. Yamakas, the public, young people in particular, the environmental groups, Mr. Peter, and things like that, they've heard it all before, but nothing happened. Well, Mr. Bigger, of course, they've heard it all before. We've heard it all before, but nothing happened. I mean, we heard about the program they were going to implement, all of the environmental friendly things they were going to do, and we saw nothing done. Now, Mr. Speaker, you may say, oh, this government, we haven't done enough. And you know what, Mr. Speaker, the honorable member of the public said, and members of the public said to us, we haven't done enough, they will find themselves in violent agreement with us. In violent agreement with us. Because we can never do enough. We want always to do more. We are accused of wanting to do too much, Mr. Speaker. And honorable members of the public, honorable members of the public, operate between telling us that we should stop doing so much because it's costing too much, and that we won't be able to do it, and telling us that we haven't done enough. We're doing the same breath in the same debate. We're doing the same breath in the same debate. But look, it is absolutely true. And it's not just politicians. Every single one of us is letting down this planet. Every single one of us is failing to do enough. My children are better advocates for the planet and for the future than I have ever been. I'm proud of that, and so of all their children also. To a great extent, Mr. Speaker, these will be educational policies promoted by Mr. Nguyen and by Mr. Cortez, both in education and in the environment, from the moment we were elected. And that's not happened before, even better, Mr. Speaker. comment, the recycling conscious of the family. If I was open with the speaker, if I recall out, the not. I'm not going to be able to pronounce it. The not project. Or the fact that what they've done in all the schools as well to make children aware and conscious of how plastic affects kids, which are their environment, their children enjoy, etc., etc. An excellent job. That is how we create people who do not see a great sacrifice in avoiding plastic. They think it's an obligation and the right thing to do. And in collecting plastic, and in making sure that we recycle plastic. Now, speaker. Yes, a lot has been said in the past and very little has been done. A lot is now being done. And we were very clear from the moment we were elected that this is what we were about. And we have done less than we would have wanted to do. Some of it was done not as quickly as we would have wanted to do it. But I think we have taken steps in the right direction. If honourable members want to join, taking giant steps towards the future, then we must always try and do that today. Absolutely. But we need to do it from a position, we have to do it from a position of political honesty. Because if they don't, then they will not be legitimate partners of ours. Now, I have done what I think is a miracle, but I think we've done that one done quickly enough, right, in the way that they said it. But yes, from the party that says that their power station would have been a better option. We need to speak up to join us in the context of understanding this emergency of coming off that approach and joining us in understanding that here. Whoever is not a signal should be the one to throw the first lump of coal. Mr. Speaker, therefore, in that context, I invite honourable members of this to reconsider, and I don't mean the other way, yet, to reconsider the idea that they're going to abstain on this. If something is in principle important to them, in declaring emergency. So look, if you don't like the wording of some part of it, well, I don't. Take it to the view. You can do it if you like. I mean, the person can do it if you like. But it may be very not to speak, you know? But take that word. When you take that word to yourself, say to yourself, I'm talking to honourable members of the church. We are in an election year, as the Honourable Lady reminded us. There may be weeks, months left before a general election. We're going to argue about everything in the cows come home. This should not be the thing that we're arguing. The Honourable Mr. Peter and I have a much friendlier relationship now than when we were the two bulls that have to go against each other the last election. Look, it's normal. When we're all older, I hope that we'll reminisce in the days when we were in Parliament and look back on what we did and no doubt when we're older, think that we did a much better job than those that are there now. When we try to speak, when we're downstairs in general Parliament, hopefully still having coffee and enjoying each other's company, and perhaps we might be introduced to a totally new experience being pleased to speak with them. We're not up in this motion, and if they abstain and they didn't vote in favour of it, I think they will be very disappointed in themselves. I look, in the long term, this debate might be more important than some of the other debates that we have. Some of the debates that are more important now, more politically relevant, some of the things that, you know, keep our blood pressure up the most today, may turn out to be but little compared to this debate on what it is that we're concluding it. So if there is a root to their supporting it, which respects the fact that this government is taking policy positions which is going to defend, that this government is taking policy positions which we think are right and which we think they must now recognize, especially in the context of this subject. Mr. Speaker, they must take that route. They must huge set of objectives, and they must work with us in respect of the subject of this motion. Because it's too important, Mr. Speaker, for them not to do so. And Mr. Clinton, therefore, even therefore, he's not going to go up and say, we're going to abstain because we can't support it. I think that was the wrong approach to take. And this is what he's going to do. Mr. Clinton, in the next few weeks, is going to lead his party to once again not supporting the appropriation bill in the South and voting against it. So at once, Mr. Speaker, they're going to be supporting those who make claims for more money from the public bank, and at the other ones, they're going to be voting against that money being available. I'm not surprised, but I offer giving even him an olive branch on this issue. Because I know that the environment is not often being flavor of the month with finances and bankers. But there is a value to doing this, Mr. Speaker. There's a value to doing this beyond township and health. There's a value to doing this beyond this moment, beyond the lifetime of this parliament. And in a way where we look back, recognizing the work we have done, giving us deep credit for it, they would have wanted to be supportive of it. Mr. Speaker, it is important to recognize that when you go into politics, you do it because there is a higher calling than just achieving political office. If there's one man of whom that is that, or of whom that is true, in particular in the parliament itself, it's going to be. It was difficult to pry him away from his botanic garden. It is difficult sometimes to make him realize that he's a minister in the government and not a gardener in a botanic garden. And that is his enduring credit, Mr. Speaker, because we have to make difficult decisions in government, and that's of course the case for all governments. He makes him take even more difficult decisions, and he makes the difficult decisions sometimes even harder. And we want him to do that, and we want him to continue to do that, because this calling for him, in my view, is really just for achieving the sort of purpose that we are debating in this house. And I think I want to recognize the contribution he has made in the past 7.5 years, and I hope for longer, in respect of turning the tinker that was the Gibraltar economy in the direction that was taken in the context of the environment, and ensuring that we started to take those steps that have identified the right the damage we were doing, try and do less damage, try and contain that damage, not to pretend that we can shoulder all the burden for the world, but to achieve what we have achieved today and what is to be achieved in the coming weeks and months, and I know we can take great pleasure in that. So, in that context, I want to signify as a leader of the House and as leader of the political party on this side of the House, our full support for the initiative that we have taken under the leadership of the Conservatives, and our full support for his leadership in bringing this climate change emergency closer to the House. And in particular, Mr. Speaker, the work that he does with young people, the way that he engages with young people, especially those young people, and environmental consciousness has been really making itself heard, not just in Gibraltar, but around the world. And I look forward to continuing to see, hear, and feel in the context of this debate that we go forward.
I'll keep my contribution short because the matter has been said by members of Parliament, and indeed it's not difficult for them to associate myself with the vast majority of what has been said on this side of the House and on the other side of the House. And I will attempt to bridge the gap between the government and the opposition in a moment. But I will say this, that the Honourable Chief is absolutely right.
and he says that this isn't about the election, this is about the fact that this is a general election year, it's not about the fact that we're offering goodies to the EAG or anybody or any other NGO or anything of the sort. This is about survival. Survival of the planet, survival of mankind on the planet. That is what this is about. And if you don't see it the way that we go about our lives, not just as political parties and the policies that we may have, but our lives, then I fear that, I think the worst for humanity and for the planet that we live in. And that is the reason why, for example, we can all talk about global warming and reducing greenhouse emissions and this and that and the other. But the real point in talking about this is the real point in voting for a motion like that was the money. You know, we're taking the family out for an Argentinian grilling on a Friday evening. It's about changing the way that our lifestyle, that's what it's about. That's why, for example, in my own home, if I can make a call, in my own home, we don't use red meat. Not only because we don't like the way that the animals are slaughtered, but also because it contributes, animal agriculture contributes between 40 and 19% to global warming. I think we're not capable of really changing the way that we lead our lives, then unfortunately, there's going to be a continued deterioration in these issues, and unfortunately, in the planet and everything else that anybody else has mentioned. But, Mr. Speaker, I can't say I will keep my contribution to this. That's what I want to say, but I want to go try and attempt to bridge the gap between the government and the opposition. But the conclusion, this wording. And the assembly paragraph, if I may read it, the paragraph that separates the government of the opposition, anybody reading the document is this. This is the paragraph. The government has already said foresight and leadership when it comes to addressing recent climate breakdown, including the replacement of renewable power generation by less committed energy and by further committed to increasing the use of renewable source of energy to at least 20% by 2020. What I propose is this. I'm going to read in these terms. The government believes it has already shown foresight and leadership when it comes to addressing the issue of climate breakdown, including the replacement of diesel power generation by less polluting energy. And while there are differences between the government and the opposition on these issues, both are further committed to increasing the use of renewable energy to at least 20% by 2050. That is the amendment that I'm proposing. And I would also like to say unity in relation to this so that we can all vote in favour of this motion. I think they are small amendments, I believe them to be reasonable, and I believe them that the office of voting for them.
Thank you, Mr. Speaker.
We were putting in writing that if the government had looked really, there was no prospect of that amendment succeeding, then I won't give it away. But if the government says, I will give it away. I'm grateful for how much I'm giving away. The government is not so low. We want to put it in writing because I think it may be possible for us to agree with it. The first amendment is an easy one because it's just one word and what I expected is really important. Which I might come back to and suggest that you consider, but I might accept the rule. I think consider this is probably a better motion of work than the news, but we're not going to fall out of that. And then I didn't quite catch the second bit, and I don't know that the. Well, I'm proposing an amendment. We're debating the amendment before we speak, but
active opposition to the Liberal Grove, then it would include the Arbor Lady instead of a bingo, which would be the official opposition. But the Arbor gentleman will just allow me to reflect that the Honourable Deputy does the same to me, that doesn't recognise, and I think this is the point I was making earlier, that LNG is better than diesel. I mean, if we don't need to have that debate, do we? I mean, LNG is better than diesel, they do accept it. And therefore, I'd like to see the statement, the amendment in writing, so we can consider that. I might invite the other gentleman, therefore, if he wants to declare the new paragraph in writing, so that we can consider that, and that we might take a recess for 10 minutes. It's almost 6 o'clock on a Friday afternoon.
Improve
which I attended, I think it can always be seen as an important moment. I really do think that in the history of the nations of the old world, and my hand in particular, to be able to move to agreement on the issue of emotion that mentions LNG is indeed a red letter day compared to where we were the last time we had a discussion.
And now put the question, which is the amendment moved by the Honourable Daniel Fitton. Those in favour? Against? Carried? So, the before the House is the motion as amended. Does any other person wish to contribute to the debate? If not, I call on the mover to reply. The Honourable Dr. John Cortes.
Thank you very much, Mr. Speaker, and I am grateful to the members opposite for their eventual positive response to the motion, which is very welcome. I must say, Mr. Speaker, that I am actually quite touched at the way that some have been converted to the environmental cause over the last few years. And I've done nothing in this, but I've achieved that. Or I must say that there must have been a crowd on the road to Damascus at some stage. Mr. Speaker, I'm particularly grateful, of course, to the Chief Minister for his kind words about me personally. I must say that during the way of referring to me, saying that on environment I have hollow words and inaction, still helps somewhat, and I'm glad to say that politics haven't completely fired me. But I think that the outcome of the debate has been positive. I do have to answer quickly some of the points that the Honourable Members of the Group made. One of the criticisms that have been made here, and I think the Honourable Lady mentioned it, is that we've heard it all before. It is true, because we've heard a lot of it before, but never to be discussed in this house, and I think that this debate is hugely significant. We are the second country to hopefully, when we take it to the vote, declare a climate emergency. We were only just beaten here by the UK Parliament 2 days ago. You were probably reading my Twitter feed, Mr. Corbyn, but I think significantly that was a motion from the opposition and not the government motion. So I think there is a significant difference there. So I think it's more than just words, and it's not the same words that we've heard before. I'm very pleased that we have had this debate. This debate would not have been possible with the political configuration of this house back in 2011, or rather before the 9th of December 2011. And I think it is a huge achievement, and that we must all accept that, and that we have all moved on. Because, Speaker, in those days, renewable energy and energy efficiency were not even in the vocabulary, and the government of the time, I must say, and I experienced it, and that's part of why I'm here today, was in fact in environmental denial. Speaker, not one solar panel, we were even told that it was impossible to plug in solar power to the grid. Speaker, I have to thank in particular the Honourable Lady for her largely positive contribution, although I do believe that some of the points were at times less than fair. I would like to reassure her that action will not wait to the end of the year, and steps will be taken and are being taken, about which I will report shortly. I believe that we need this declaration because we can now use it, and those of us who believe in the need for climate action can refer to this motion and strengthen us in working with other sectors of the community in taking these principles forward. The purpose
take them on board as soon as possible. I think that overall this has been positive, the honorable minister's contribution was positive and helpful. In relation to delays, I think it's true that for a considerable amount of time we were working very closely with the European Union source of funds. That sadly Brexit could take to, and that did cause a significant delay in our rolling our program forward. In relation to the students, yes, I think they are an inspiration to all of us, but I also feel that I must say that I no longer feel as lonely as I used to feel when I was alone, and I was almost a voice in the wilderness. In relation to another point that the Honourable Lady raised, the point of reclamation, as I said in my speech, we are aiming at carbon neutral and possibly a carbon negative development there. And it was very excited in making this an advantage. Did I have any further on to the contribution by Mr. Thompson? He says that he and others may have wanted advance notice of a motion. I did mention it to him on Friday, that I was hoping to take it today. But it didn't come as a surprise. This is a climate emergency that we're declaring. They told me, we're going to take it as a first possible opportunity. The first possible opportunity is today. The motion is public for all to see, and it becomes no surprise that it came today. I would like to comment that I did not feel that the language that had been used in relation to LNG was politically valid, but we resolved that, so I'm not going to go into that. But in relation to the climate change act, the government is well aware of my willingness to discuss and my experience of this on the heritage, and I think it's naturally worked together, and we can expect that I'm going to be receptive to comments as can the rest of the people. One point, if I may refer now to Mr. Gamas's contribution, renewable 0.05% in 2011, 0.00000% not even in the department, but I'm going to surprise Mr. Gamas by only a couple of days ago. This is the proposal from our solar plant, which is producing, I think, 0.6 or 0.7 kilowatts at the time, and there will be a public presentation of it as early as next week, and others have been rolled out, including the one that my honourable friend is placing on the rooftops of the new sports facilities, and that already will be making a higher contribution. The Speaker's energy is not ideal. The Chief Minister confirmed that that is the view on this side of the House, and it's clearly now the view of the whole House. But it is a natural step into Gibraltar's energy transition. It is clearly better than diesel. This is an energy transition. We cannot stop one thing down and expect renewables to take over immediately. So it is a necessary, crucial, and significant step. And we have to bank that as progress and not deny that it is a positive development. Going apart from the reduction in carbon, LNG does not produce as much carbon dioxide as it is oxide, virtually no particulate matter, and that is another quality issue which is related to, but not the issue being discussed today. So I think that is something we have to recognize. I think that Mr. Gamas did, towards the end of the contribution, make a number of positive suggestions, and I would be happy to discuss them with him and take them on board if we aren't already taking action on those particular aspects. I don't think that our targets are realistic. If you add the 21% drop in power generation emissions from 2013 to last year to a possible 25% drop because of using LNG, we're already getting quite close. I think to sum up, and this is really my last contribution this evening, it's not about what has been done or what has not been done, we all know that there is a lot to do. The very often there are once again, leading the fight against all sorts of environmental catastrophes. So very recently, we have 20 years to get this right. But when you look into the future, it seems like a long time to get this thing, 2031. But if you think back to 12 years ago, it was only 2007, that's when one starts to be worried. So clearly we have to say, we have to take action, let's do it, because that one must be supporting this motion, which I once again commented on.
I now put the question, which is the motion moved by the Honourable Dr. John Cochrane. All in favour? Those in favour? Those against? Carried unanimously. Honourable Chief Minister. The Speaker, on that happy and concordant note, I rise to adjourn the House until next Thursday, the 9th of May. At 3 p.m. in the afternoon. The Speaker also gave an indication to honourable members, and I know that they have already the estimate of distributed by the clerk, but I'm considering the budget debate occurring on Monday the 10th of June, and I'm still considering that date. The date that is in my diary at the moment, but because we have the issues that we have lurking in the background still, which is the thread that can happen. In the moment of the war between the Conservative government and the Labour opposition in the United Kingdom, it is possible that that may change. And to share my thinking along with the members, this year we have the Ireland game starting in the second week of July. I know that we may have a lot going on in that period. And we, of course, there will also be the UN session in Israel. So the wiggle that I'm looking at is the window of the 10th of June, otherwise it would likely be much later. So, Speaker, if one of the members want to dialogue that, then I think that would be of assistance. So, everyone, and finally, Speaker, before I speak to adjourn, I am conscious of the fact that today is World Press Freedom Day, Mr. Speaker. And I should, therefore, I know that on behalf of the whole House, want to congratulate all journalists in Gibraltar and remind them that they enjoy around them a ring of steel of freedom to be able to write and say what they wish when they wish in the discharge of their obligations to keep us all informed at all times in as free and fair a way as we wish. Thank you. We can move the House now adjourned to next Thursday to hear. The House will now adjourn to next Thursday, the 9th of May, at 3 in the afternoon.